How is everybody this morning? Good. As I was preparing the last couple weeks for this, it seemed like my mind went three different places, three different messages converged, and I had felt like my thoughts were like pieces of paper scattered in a breeze, and I was trying to grab the ones that were needed and the ones, let the other ones fly away. And so we're hoping that it all comes together. I was sitting at Uncle Herman's funeral Thursday, listening to Brother singing, and a thought came to my mind that we have this, we as humans have this view that life begins at birth and ends at death, and that our entrance into heaven is our greatest transition in life, and that's the moment we're all looking for, and that's where life begins in a sense. And I started thinking, partly because of this and partly because of other now I don't have my right version, but anyway, that what if that's not the greatest transition in life? And I'm not so sure that it is anymore. I'm thinking more and more that the greatest transition in my life and my life's journey happened at the cross. And we see these graphs to help us get a grasp of our own mortality, or these lines, and saying, if this is history and eternity, this is your little life here. And then I'm like, No, it's that little blip is probably my life before Christ. But at the moment I knelt the cross, my life fills up the rest of that line. And yours does too. You were a different creation when you knelt at the cross, a new creation. You died, you're buried, and you're raised again, a completely new creation. So who you were no longer exists. And it's at that moment that I think that we enter our promised land, or we have the ability to take possession of our promised land. I used to think the promised land was heaven. But when you start reading, you realize there's enemies in the promised land. There's enemies they have to defeat. Well, there's no enemies in heaven that I have to conquer. And so if there's enemies in my promised land, then there must be more to this promised land than just heaven. It must start beforehand. And I believe it starts at the cross. And what happens so many times, we forget or lose focus of the fact that Jesus' death rescued us from slavery to sin and the law and death. And so we spend so much of our time trying to conquer sin that we don't inhabit our promised land. And my challenge today is to start taking possession of your promised land. Tim's laid his past sermons on the partial gospel have been fantastic in helping us understand that sin is done. It's been dealt with. It's not that big of an issue anymore to God. That we do have power over sin. Sin does not have power over us. And that we don't need to spend our entire lives conquering the sin within that's already been dealt with. We need to conquer the enemies that are in our land. We need to inhabit our land, our promised land. So you might ask, what do you mean by promised land? And we're gonna part of our promised land is our destiny, our calling. And if you remember the Israelites, I'll get to the scripture in a moment. If you remember the Israelites, if you had a map, I thought about bringing one. The whole promised land was divided up into territories. Each tribe had a territory that they were supposed to take care of, conquer the enemies, and maintain. And then there were times that they helped each other, right? And so you have an area of God's kingdom that he is calling for you to inhabit, to conquer, and to advance. There are times that they called the rest of the tribes to come together, and there's times you need brothers and sisters to come together to help you conquer the enemies in your land. But your promised land started there. And my challenge to you today is to remember that your sin has been dealt with, and to challenge you to conquer, take over your promised land. So if you'll turn to Exodus 23, or 19 first. I'm getting little snippets from the Israelite, their journey into the promised land. And so I can't just, there's not like it's all one story in one chapter. So if you turn to 19 first, and my iPad is fluky. I always have to go back to the book before I can just change the chapter. God has already clearly stated his plan. He came to Moses and clearly told him what he wanted to do. He wanted to bring his people out of bondage to a good and broad land, a land of abundance and flowing with milk and honey. And he's already told us that as well. I've made a place for you. All things are possible here. So come on. Come on. I've got this place for you. Ephesians, he laid out his plan for us as well. That before he made the world, he loved us and he chose us in Christ to be with him, to be holy and blameless. That's already been decided. So he's let us know that. And at the right time, he will bring things together under the authority of Christ. We've received an inheritance from God because he chose us in advance. And he makes everything work out according to his plan. So the angel came to Moses and told Moses that this is God's plan. This is going to happen. I'm going to bring them out of bondage and I'm going to bring them to a good land flowing with milk and honey. And he's told us, I've already decided that you're going to be holy and blameless. I have chosen you in advance and I've made a way. I've made a way for you to move in that. And all things work out according to my plan. But the problem was, the Israelites had a mentality they had to get over. They had to renew their minds in a sense. And if you look at verses 4 through 6. This is what he told Moses. They came to Mount Sinai. And he told Moses to tell the Israelites this. You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice, keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now, does that remind you of something that one of the apostles has said? There's a verse in the New Testament that's almost identical to that. It's in 1 Peter. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. So in the same way, he took the Israelites there at Mount Sinai, and he said, I want you to be a treasured my people, a holy nation, a royal priesthood. And he's telling us when we come to the cross, I have chosen you to be a holy nation, a royal priesthood, for my own possession. To proclaim to the world, your promised land, the people in your promised land, in your area, the excellence of him who's called you out of slavery into freedom, out of darkness into light. But their mentality, and if you go to the next chapter, we'll find out what they said. If you look at verses 19 through 20, well, I will start at verse 18. Now when all the people saw the thunder and flashes of lightning and the sound of a trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled, and they stood far off. And they said to Moses, you speak to us and we'll listen, but don't let God speak to us, lest we die. God had already told them what he wanted. He wanted to come down and commune with them. And they said, no, we're too afraid. Moses, you talk to us and we'll listen. And then God gave, and that's in the beginning, in the early stages of him giving the law. In the next number of chapters in Exodus, he gives us the law. God wanted to commune with them. He wants to commune with us so that we can take possession. We have the power and the authority and the confidence to take our promised land. But they were so accustomed to slavery. They were so accustomed to be told what to do every morning, what to follow, everything, where to go, that they said, no, Moses, you speak to us and you just tell us what to do. And it's sad to me when I really think about that. And there are other places where the Israelites stood at their tent and watched Moses go into the tent and meet with God. And God talk with him as a man speaks to a friend. Their mindset, their slavery mindset, kept them wanting the law rather than relationship. And that's what happens to us so many times. We're so conscious of our sin that we're afraid to let go, we're afraid to enter in a relationship. I'm not sure what God is going to say. And we also feel comfortable with the law. Just tell us what to do. They want somebody, just tell me what to do. Just tell me what to do. We were talking the other morning, and he brought up riding on a bicycle. If you ride, our oldest kids, we never let them have training wheels because we didn't want them to get used to training wheels. Some of them absolutely had to have them. But you think about a child riding on training wheels, they learn to depend on those training wheels, and you take them off, they're terrified. The training wheels keep them up, and sometimes we think the law keeps us up. The Israelites are obviously used to that. They're used to being enslaved to the law. And you remove that, I don't know what to do. Walk in relationship with him. It's going to take some time for you to find your balance. Like a five-year-old learning to ride a bike, it takes some time to find their balance. And they fall and they get hurt. But the New Testament is very clear. We're dead to sin, and we're dead to the law as well. We don't need the law to dictate what we're supposed to do, because we can commune with God and find out what he wants. The law can, the Bible can, is to guide us, and I'm going to get to that shortly. But there are numerous scriptures. Romans 6:14, sin doesn't have any dominion over you since you're not under law. Romans 7:6, we've been released from the law, having died to that which held us captive. So we serve in a new way of the Spirit, a relationship, a communion. And not in the old way of written code. Galatians 2:19, I died to the law that I might live to God. In a relationship, listening to his voice, communing with him, learning to know his heart. Galatians 4, the law is likened to a guardian that was necessary for a time, but not any longer. And also likened to Hagar. And Abraham was told to cast out that slave woman. And Colossians 2, you died with Christ. You've been set free from the spiritual power. So why do you keep on following rules? Do not handle, do not touch, do not taste. They have the appearance of godliness. They're human teachings that seem wise because they require discipline and pious self-denial. But they don't provide you any help in conquering evil desires. There's your only help in conquering evil desires. Kneeling at the cross, dying, being buried with him, raised again to a new life, and then stepping forward into your promised land to conquer it. But when we have this mindset, we still feel bound to sin and bound to the law, we're unable to take possession of our promised land because we're so busy with these things that have already been taken care of. We're so busy crucifying ourselves that we don't realize we've already been crucified. If you want to jump forward, if you want to follow with me, to jump forward to Numbers 13, yeah. Still a little more of their slave mentality that they had to get rid of. And I wrote the wrong verses down here, I know that. All right. Okay. Moses had sent the spies in to spy out the Canaan. You know, God had already told them they could get it. I'm still not really sure why Moses went ahead and did that. You know, if God's already told you we can possess something, there's no point in you checking out to see if you can do it. Because if he's telling you to do it, he's not going to set you up for failure. And if you're spying it out to see if you can do it, chances are you're trying to figure out if you can do it on your own strength, which is exactly what the Israelites did. When they came back and they brought word, verse 26, they came back, brought word, and showed them the fruit of the land. They told them, we came to the land through which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. However, the people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of Negev, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites. They start listing all these enemies. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea. Now, Caleb quieted them and said, no, let's go up and occupy it. We can overcome it. Caleb didn't have the slave mentality. Caleb knew if God said we can do this, we can do this. So let's go ahead and do it. But what happened to the people? They were ready to stone them. And they were like, no. They wept all night. They raised a loud cry. I can imagine. We've come all this way. We're not going to be able to do this. Sorry. And they were angry, and they mumbled, and they grumbled. And we see here that all the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, I wish we died in the land of Egypt, or that we had died in the wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? And they said to one another, let's choose a leader and go back to Egypt. And if you read the whole story, God came, down, and he talked to them. They already stoned Joshua and Caleb. And finally, the Lord said in verse 11, how long will these people despise me? How long are they going to doubt what I've done? They've seen the Red Sea parted. They've seen the miracles I did in the land of Egypt. Fine, he said, basically. And he had them wander in the wilderness for 40 years. Now, if you know, 40 years, we're familiar with the concept that 40 years is basically a generation. And the entire generation had to die. But it wasn't that God was punishing them. You had a whole generation that had a slave mentality. And he needed to raise up a new generation who believed them, who could see themselves as free men, who could see themselves in a different light, who had a new mentality. Not a slave mentality, because with a slave mentality, they're unable to take possession of their promised land. They saw all the enemies there, and that's all they saw. And they didn't think that they could conquer it, those enemies. When we see ourselves as slaves, when we see us, particularly if we still see ourselves in bondage, selves in bondage to sin, we're still enslaved to that. We're still enslaved to our old nature. We're not going to be able to take our promised land. We're not going to have the energy to take care of the enemies that are out there because we're still dealing with all the enemies inside that really have already been taken care of. And so we're unable to take possession of what God has given us. We're unable to step into our destiny fully. We'll be able to function, and we'll be able to see a measure of success in whatever calling God gives us. I'm not saying we're useless, but we're never going to see the full potential. We're never going to really feel free walking in our destiny because we're still seeing ourselves as slaves. We still see too many giants that could devour us. You know, on December 18th, 1865, Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, declaring all the slaves in the rebellious states to be free from that day forward. But many of them continued to live like slaves. Some hadn't heard it. Some woke up the next day in the same cabin, the same plantation. They went to the same work. They did everything they did before, and they said, nothing's changed, so we must still be slaves. But there's also an element that some of them, they needed to learn how to live like free men. They needed someone to come alongside. They needed to learn how to read. They needed to learn how to do math, to be able to manage money, to have bank accounts, to be able to do transactions with other free men, to know how to avoid being deceived and being fooled. So they had a whole lot of things they need to learn that they didn't need to take care of before. And when we come out of slavery to sin, we do need to learn how to live like free men. We need to know this is what free men live like. They love each other. They turn the other cheek. They forgive multiple times. They don't use their freedom to someone else's disadvantage. And that the New Testament is full of all those things to help us learn to live like free men. Sadly, in my own life, I've done this. I've turned that into another list of rules and law, another law. There are 613 laws in the Old Testament. There are over 1,000 in the New. And if you can't fulfill the laws of the Old Testament, you're not going to be able to fulfill the laws of the New Testament. It's a way of God showing you, you were a slave to sin, you're not anymore. This is what free men look like. This is what sons of mine look like. This is what disciples of Christ live like. When he says, if you love me, you'll keep your commandments, it's kind of a, duh, if you're going to love me, you're going to do what I ask. Because you're going to know my heart, you're going to want to do what I want you to do. It's not a, well, if you keep my commandments, then I know you'll love me. When we love people, his greatest commandment is to love people as I have loved you. That is not a new, to love people was not new. The standard was what was new. To love people like Christ loves. And if you could love people like Christ loves, all those 1,000 rules in the New Testament will be taken care of. And even what Dennis talked about this morning, when we fall in love with Jesus, we fall in love with his people, and we want to help them. It's not a, well, I got to go help somebody today. It's no, I get to go help somebody today. Because that's what it looks like to live like free men. We don't need somebody telling, well, if you're a member of this church, you have to at least help 6 people in the next 6 months. You need to show up at this many functions, you know. If you love Jesus, you love this people, you love this congregation, you're going to want to do it. And if you don't, keep falling in love more and more with Jesus and asking him for his heart for his people. Because I guarantee when your heart gets broken, you're going to be there. You're not going to need a rule. You're not going to need leadership to tell you have to be there. So we need to change our thinking. That's what repent means. That's the word metanoeo. And it means to change your thinking. It doesn't mean to cry, and it may involve tears. I've felt more remorse over my sins in the last couple of years since I've fallen more and more in love with Jesus than I think I ever have before. And so it's going to involve that. It's going to involve forgiveness. But if you haven't changed your thinking, you haven't really repented. So we need to focus on the reality that sin is not the issue. So we can embrace God's plan. So we can step into our promised land. But now this is going to come with a warning. Because when we step into God's plan, we step into our promised land, there are enemies there. We end up sinning. We end up falling. Part of that is because we're still learning to ride a bike without training wheels. Part of that is still parts of our heart that haven't and our mind that haven't been renewed yet. If I see myself as a failure, things are going to reflect that. I need to stop seeing myself as a failure long before I'm going to see evidence of it. And I'd read the verses there in 2 and 3 and where the Israelites were discouraged. They got to the promised land. It wasn't what they were hoping for. And they didn't think they could handle it. And when we sin, we face discouragement. And there are people who are, and I've talked with people who are caution against us preaching the whole gospel and that sin has no power over us, because then when people sin, they feel like a failure and they give up. And so why discourage them? Well, did Jesus discourage the adulterous woman when he said, go and sin no more? Was he setting her up for failure? The Apostle John in 1 John says, I write these things so that you sin no more. Well, is he setting us up for failure? If the apostles and Jesus can say it's possible, then it's possible. I haven't seen it in my own life yet, but that's what I'm focusing on now, rather than focusing on the fact, well, I'm only human. Now I keep thinking, well, there is a divine nature in me. Somehow that's going to have to come out in this situation next time. I have to figure out what's keeping that divine nature bottled up when I face these situations. I need to conquer this. If you look at the enemies in the land, there are various ones mentioned. There are several places, and I'm not going to go to all of them. In Exodus 3, when God talked to Moses, he listed some, and there we just listed some here in Exodus 19 or 20. I'd have to go back and see what it was. And then in Judges 3, when Joshua died, it said that God left the five rulers in the land. And he did it for several reasons. But before I do that, I found it very interesting as I was studying for this, and I just want to go through this briefly. Each of the names of those enemies has a meaning, okay? The Canaanites meant merchant or trafficker. And it can speak to our desire for money and the influence the world has on us in that area. It can. I'm not saying money is all bad. The Hittites came from the word heth, which means sons of terror. Is fear not one of our biggest enemies? The Amorites meant talker. It was derived from a word that meant someone who boasted, words without action. I'm good at that. I have good intentions and I can talk. I like to talk. But sometimes my actions don't back up my talk. It's one of my enemies. Saying things without really backing them or exaggerating to make my point, to prove my point. The Perizzites and Hivites, that word means villager. How many of us have a commoner mentality, a villager mentality? I'm a nobody. I really can't do anything for God. God can't use me. I'm not good enough. He can use Dennis and he can use Bob, but he just can't use me. We just feel so. Part of that is a false humility, a self-deprecation. But part of it is really a belief that I'm not good enough. And if that's your belief, it's time to repent, change your thinking. If God has called you, you're good enough. Jebusites means to trample or tread down. And that's exactly what the enemy wants to do. Satan wants to trample you down and leave you so you don't get up again. Also, the Jebusites lived near Jerusalem, the heart of Israel. And that's exactly where the enemy wants to occupy. He wants to occupy your heart and the center of your life. Philistines, that's in Judges 3. The root word of the Philistines comes from the word that means to wallow. Anybody else here like to wallow in self-pity, self-deprecation? Yeah, we like to wallow around. It's a common enemy, probably for most, if not all of us. Sidonians is another one. That means hunter. We have a hunter seeking whom he may devour. So all the enemies in the Israelites' land really in some way represents many of our enemies. And God didn't drive them all out at once. So when you come to the cross, he's not going to get rid of all those things at once. It's not like all of a sudden you're going to be this perfect angel. You're going to learn. You're going to learn. But you've got enemies. In Exodus 23, and you can turn there if you want. You don't. I mean, it's just a couple of verses I was going to read there because I think I didn't read all of them when I was there. Yeah. Verse 29, he says, I'm not going to drive them out before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and wild beasts multiply against you. And as I was reading this, I don't know if there's a... It reminded me of the verse in Matthew where Jesus said not to drive... If you drive out the demons and nothing replaces it, they'll come and find it, swept clean, and okay? So we need to replace... And it kind of reminded me of that. I don't know really if there's a correlation, but I've been really praying. So what does it mean for my land to become desolate? What does it mean that you're driving them out little by little so that that land doesn't become desolate? Part of it is I think that I need to learn to walk in the measure that I've received. And part of it is so other things don't come and take up that. If all of a sudden we were just completely free, I know one wild animal would come into my life and that'd be pride. I'd feel pretty good if all of a sudden I knelt at the cross and all my enemies were gone. I'd be feeling pretty good. And I will set your border from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines and from the wilderness to the Euphrates, for I will give the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. I will give the enemies into your hand, and you shall drive them out. So it sounds like the Israelites had something to do with driving their enemies out. So when I enter my promised land, it's not going to be peachy keen. I'm going to mess up sometime. I hate saying I'm going to mess up because that means it sounds like inevitable. I don't want to. And I no longer believe I have the propensity to, but I still have the capacity to. Little by little, as God drives out our enemies, as we drive out our enemies, as we cooperate with him, we go to battle with him, we conquer our giants, we increase in strength and take possession. And as I take possession of my anger, and I walk in that for a while and learn how to respond without anger, then I have another area of my promised land I need to conquer. And I have people. I need to conquer my anger. I need to have control of my anger before I can reach that person in my life who is driving me crazy, who is constantly, when she needs me, she calls me. And I do what I can, and then she goes, you know, that person you're trying to help who just never gets the message. See? But it's like, God, you need to show her that you love her, because it's not me. And so we grow, we gain strength, we learn to walk in each new freedom, and then he shows us something else. We need to learn to walk, learn to ride it without training wheels. And then we learn to ride a bigger bike. We might learn to go further and further beyond our driveway, and soon we're riding on the ride to missions, a couple hundred miles. And it's not about me conquering. It's about me conquering these enemies so that I can increase my land and those who are with me, those who I touch on the streets, in the prison, at the strip clubs when we go, the homeless. They see. And I can respond because more and more of my heart is occupied by Jesus. Verse 32 and 33 there of Exodus 23 says, don't make a covenant with them. They're not going to dwell in your land lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will become a snare to you. Later on, you're reading their story that they didn't drive them out. They controlled them. They put them to use. They put them to forced labor. I don't know that I would... Sometimes I thought that my anger was a good thing, that it could be used. I tried to control it. But so many times we try to cage our enemies rather than destroy our enemies. If we don't drive out the enemies, if we don't conquer the enemies of our land, we're going to get accustomed to them. And they're going to become a snare. And chances are very good our children are going to have to deal with them. Up till today, I've always said I'm domestically challenged. Today, the Lord convicted me that saying, not saying that, saying I have been. Okay, so if you come to my house, the evidence is all there that I still am. Okay, but that's an area of my life that I've passed on to my kids. Okay, and I've seen it. How many people have seen, I've seen people who are women who are angry at men and very sexist, yet nothing has happened to them. Everything they see because a lens has been passed down from their mom. And the sins of one generation are visited upon the sins of another generation. So you've got giants in your land that you don't want to conquer. Your kids are going to have to conquer them later. God is intent upon us occupying our promised land. In fact, later on in Numbers 14, when God got aggravated, he said, how long are they going to despise me? He was ready to wipe them out. What Moses did, and isn't the only time he did it, he reminded them, yeah, but if you do that, the Egyptians are going to say you were not able to bring them to your promised land, to their promised land. So in a very real sense, when God is so intent on enabling and strengthening you to fulfill your promised land because he knows the whole host of the enemy is watching. He's been completely defeated. All he's got is a voice. But he's not going to give the enemy any reason to say, see, I knew you couldn't take that one into their promised land. You weren't able to do it. You weren't strong enough to get that one there. God has given everything we can, and all we have to do is cooperate. Little by little, I will drive them out, he says. And it's cooperating with him. It's allowing him to wash us. It's allowing him to expose those lies, those thinking patterns that are keeping us trapped with certain enemies so that he can drive them out. And I read there that Joshua and Caleb, their response was, we can take this, guys. Sure, they're big, but we got God on our side. We can do this. Because they had lost the slave. They saw what God had done. And they knew that God was faithful. They were aware of their identity as chosen people. They believed when God said, I have chosen you to be a holy nation, my own possession. They believed it. And because they believed in their identity, because they were confident in who they were able to lead the Israelites through the wilderness and then into the promised land when they came back 40 years later. They were able to give the vision, the courage, the strength to keep going. And they didn't grumble that they had to go through the wilderness too. I think I would have. I'm like, wait, this ain't right here. I'm ready. I'll go in by myself then. They can go back. I am not wandering that wilderness for 40 years. 3 months was long enough for me. His cousin posted something. His cousin Dale posted something on his Facebook. I thought, that's my sermon in a paragraph. I probably could just read that and be done. And it was that, you know, Joshua and Caleb knew their identity, okay? And when we know our identity, basically, this is the gist of it, our wilderness experience will only be a transition and not our life. God wants that. There is a transition. There is a time period of learning. And we have wildernesses we go through that are various wilderness. But if we're not going to accept, if we don't by faith choose to believe what God has said about us, we're going to stay in the same wilderness and go around that mountain over and over and over again. And it will be our life rather than just a transition. It doesn't mean that we're not going to have other wildernesses. I'm not saying that. Because we go through other wildernesses that teach us new things, that teach us deeper things about him and about ourselves. That's good. That's all good. It was amazing what God had done for the Israelites in bringing them out of slavery into their promised land. He had done many miraculous things. He crossed the Red Sea, the plagues. They had seen the manna. All that he had done, delivering them from. But that was not his greatest work. His greatest work happened in the promised land. in creating them, bringing them up, raising them up to be his chosen people. It's what he delivered them for. And what God has delivered us for is far more amazing than what he has delivered us from. He's delivered us, each of us. We've had different backgrounds. We've had different histories. We have different struggles. But he's delivered us all from the greatest enemy of all. He's delivered us all from bondage to sin, slavery, sin, death, and the law. And it's amazing. But we can't stay there. Come back to there once in a while. But we need to step into our promised land, because the work he is going to do, what he wants to do, is far more amazing than what he's already done in your life. And he's challenging us, take hold of the promised land. I want to expand this area. I want this church, this people, to grow and expand and infect and affect the surrounding communities. And what he's going to do in your life as you take possession of your promised land is far more amazing than what he's ever done. Your destiny that he has for you, your potential that he has for you, is beyond your, it's more than you can think or imagine, is what Paul tells us. In closing, early in the, actually some legends say for hundreds of years, men have been trying to break the 4-minute mile. And it was believed to be completely impossible. And as more and more runners tried and failed, scientists, doctors, experts all said the human body could not run a sub-4-minute mile. In the 1940s, the record was set at 4 minutes and 1 second. And experts declared that is the human limit. We will not get any faster in running the mile. It's impossible. It's been tried for hundreds, if not thousands of years. In fact, some legends say of people tying bulls behind them to make them run faster. It didn't work, I guess. I'm not sure what happened to them, because I'm not that crazy. I'll just as soon stick with a 50-minute mile as to have a bull come after me. For 9 years after that four-minute, one-second record was, men tried to break it. And more people were thinking perhaps it was impossible. Perhaps the human body had reached its limit. Until May 6, 1954, when Roger Bannister ran the mile 0.6 seconds less than 4 minutes. It was done. The 4-minute mile was broken. Do you know, 6 weeks later, somebody else shattered his record by 2 seconds. And within a year, others followed. Until now, 60 years later, it's the standard for milers. The 4-minute is, even strong high schoolers can run a 4-minute mile. What happened? The record today is 3:43.13. Can we break the 3-minute mile? I realize we can't do it in 0 seconds, so at some point in time there is a limit. But what happened? Roger Bannister set that as his goal. He would envision breaking that. I'm assuming as I read that, as I hear say that, that he pictured him crossing the finish line, looking up at the clock and seeing 3 in that front number. Somehow. God has given our bodies a system called the reticular activating system, for short RAS. And what this system does, it helps our brain decide what to filter out and what to highlight based on what we decide to focus upon. Roger Bannister focused on breaking the 4-minute mile. And so his body, his mind, focused out anything. Just, it focused on what would help him achieve it and naturally ignored everything that wouldn't. Didn't even notice it. It didn't go in. You've been there. You've been in a conversation, the same conversation as me, and I hear one thing and you hear another. It's just what, or you've read something and all of a sudden it grabs you, and all of a sudden you hadn't seen it up to this point in time. All of a sudden you see it everywhere. Because once it's been highlighted, you notice it. When you're focusing on something, you notice those things that back it up. When you have a clearly defined purpose or mission, when you live every moment of your lives with a state of certainty that you're going to achieve it, your RAS will filter out and highlight. So when you believe, when you have your promised land in sight, and you know you're going to conquer the enemies in your land, you know that sin has been defeated. You are no longer a sinner but a saint. and you have this laid out, you know you can do it. Your body's already designed to filter out. And it's faith, I believe, that activates that RAS. It's faith that says, I feel like a failure. I feel like I'm domestically challenged, but he says I'm not. And I'm going to picture my house neat as a pin. The more grandchildren I get, the more difficult that is. Because I always have preschoolers in my home, but that's okay. Anyway, the more certainty I have, the more I focus on that, the more I filter out. And the more I focus on my successes, the more I focus on those areas that are neat, and the more I believe. Fact, if I could be so bold as to confess this, I'm in the process of reorganizing. And for the first time ever, I thought, I should have taken a before and after picture. So that when people come to my house and doubt that I really was that messy, I can show them the picture. Not to necessarily, it's more so others who are coming after me are domestically challenged can think there's hope. And isn't that what the Christian life is all about? It might be funny and I can laugh about it. A house, that's no big deal. But when I've been, you know, when someone's a mess on drugs and their life is, they feel wasted and God turns that around and they can show someone else, no, it's possible, you can do this. And they can lead them. It's no longer the blind leading the blind, but the sighted leading the blind. That's what it's all about. Me sharing my victories with you, me, my tribe, you, your area, and I can say, hey, I can do this, you can do this. Let me help you, let me pray for you, let me do whatever I can so you can conquer that area in your promised land. That's what it's all about. God delivered us for something, not just from something. We were slaves. Now we're sons. We were paupers. Now we're royalty. And he wants us to take possession of a promised land. So I challenge you to focus on that. You know, it only takes a little bit of belief, faith the size of mustard seed. There's a difference between, well, I'll try it and see if it happens, and I believe, Lord, help my unbelief. There's a difference. There's a difference. And he can work with the tiniest amount of faith. I've even seen him work with skeptical faith. You know, if you're just going to try it out to see it, just to test God, there's one way we can test God. He says, test me and see, and that's if we can outgive him. But you discern in your own heart as your approach to this, is it small faith or I'll see if it works. I've tried everything else and it don't work. Because if it's small faith, he'll reward it and your faith will grow. And little by little, he'll drive out your enemies. Little by little, you'll conquer your promised land. Little by little, you'll walk in victory. And then one day, somebody's going to look at you and they're going to want you to help them, lead them out of their wilderness into their promised land. And it's going to be a different path. It's going to be a different journey. It's not going to be the same set of steps. But you're going to know how to help them because you're not enslaved anymore. Because you know where to turn to. I've debated just doing a lifting prayer and the Holy Spirit just hasn't highlighted anything, so I'm just going to pray in closing. And you can do your own time with the Lord, helping, having him. Wes, yeah.
Linda has a word.
Okay. Linda. You got to use the mic. That's the rule.
This all ties together, and this was a word that was given to Rusty and I, but it's for the whole church. Last weekend, Rusty and I got to get away for a couple days, and the day before we went, this lady that I know, she gave me a word, and she said, I think this is a time of transition and shift. That's the word I'm getting for you and your husband. And I said, okay, well, you know, we're going away this weekend, and we'll pray about that. And then I picked up my phone to look at the time, and it was 11:11. Now, I don't know how many of you see 11, but I see 11 everywhere. I always see 11. 1:11, 11:11. And so I said to her, and she said, you know, that's got to mean something. And I know somebody that, you know, does like numbers or whatever. So she texted me later and she said, he says that it means it's a time of transition and it's a time of shift that's coming. And I was like, okay. So Rusty and I went to our hotel and we were on the 11th floor in room 11. Like, oh my dear. And then what Dennis was talking about and what we talked about in Sunday school, and Russ in Virginia reminded us that when Brian was here one time, he was talking about the number 11, and it wasn't probably the greatest word that we wanted to hear, but it was a word that I feel like you have confirmed, and Dennis too, that as the church, we're in a time of transition, and there is a shift coming, and we need to be ready. We need to be ready not just for ourselves, but for others. Because we can't help anybody else if we don't have our own stuff together. Whether it's our marriages, our finances, our health, God, He will provide everything for us for our assignment. We just have to walk it out. And we have to be ready to receive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what you were talking about with the training wheels. You know, when you take those training wheels off, it is scary. It's not comfortable. You've been used to doing things a certain way, and we've been used to believing things a certain way. But if they're either, it could be that we haven't believed or done things as well as we could have, or incorrectly, or it's just time that we're going to take new ground. And we got to get rid of those training wheels, and we've got to get on that bike, and we've got to ride. There are too many people still going to hell, and we're still trying to get our messes cleaned up. You know what, church? We got to get our messes cleaned up. We've got to get them cleaned up, and then we can get out there, and we can do what God has called us to do. We're in the world, but we're not of the world. I feel like I'm getting ready to... I'm done.
Yeah. Hold on to that prayer.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. Good.
I wasn't going to share this, but just to piggyback on what Linda was saying about being ready, yesterday at Bishop's Church, I was praying. I was speaking yesterday, and I had a whole bunch of really good stuff, lots of good scripture, lots of good stuff to share, and God totally threw that out the window in the morning, and my house was very messy. And we have all these extra kids all the time. And the kitchen was really dirty in the morning. And I was like, oh. So I thought, I'm cleaning this kitchen before I get ready to go speak because I don't want to come home. I did come home to it messy again, though, but I did. I was scrubbing and cleaning the floors. And I'm murmuring and complaining about all these kids in my house that leave stuff everywhere, crumbs. And the Lord said, you opened your home for me. And these kids come in and we witness to them and we love on them and we really care about them. And in our walk, whatever we're doing, not one of you goes through your day where you're not influenced by some dirt. Mm-hmm. The television, the radio, somebody passing you by, the air you breathe. And God said, you have to, just like you're cleaning your kitchen, you have to wash yourself daily. And He said, you have to get in the Word. And I love to get in the Word, so it's not a big problem for me, but I don't get in it as often. I mean, every day I do, but like at night I'll watch a television show or something and I won't read the Word. And then that night I read the Book of Esther. And the Book of Esther just like was so exciting and so new, and I've read it so many times. But it was an awesome story. And I didn't go to bed with all kinds of negative stuff. What I went to bed with, my thoughts were how awesome God is and how he creates situations in all of our lives for a time such as this, for a time to make an impact and an influence on the body. And I just would like to encourage you, and part of what Linda was saying and everything that Tammy was saying is not make it a law, not make it a law that you have to get into the Word, but I promise you, if you get into the Word, you're going to be cleansing all that negative, and you're just going to be filling yourself with the Spirit. You're washing yourself daily with the Word. You're cleansing. And that was the word I had. Mm-hmm.
All right, Father, Papa, we just thank you that you have cleared the way, that you have strengthened us, that you have taken care of the sin in our lives so that we could take care of we could possess our promised land, that we can walk in the calling you've given us. I thank you for your abundant, super, hyper-abundant grace that is always readily available to us, that we can call upon, we can pull down upon to strengthen us in everything we face. That your grace not only saves us, it enables us, it strengthens us. Father, I just pray with each person here that the area of their promised land that they're trying to inhabit and that they've faced defeat after defeat, I just pray against discouragement. I just speak in hope into that situation. Hope and refreshment and peace. I pray that you would just highlight and illuminate in our minds the times when we're focusing on the wrong things, that we would put in the front of our mind possessing our promised land, and that we go after that with everything, and that becomes our focus, that our focus comes off of ourselves and our own trials and struggles, and that we take care of things as you highlight them, but we also expand our promised land. And as we grow deeper and deeper and deeper into you, we expand more and more and more. I pray that for each person here, every person has an individual story, an individual enemy that they're fighting right now. Would you overwhelm them with your strength? Would you give them truth to focus upon? Bring to their mind verses, songs, whatever they need to think about and to meditate on, so they can keep that ever in front of their mind. They can keep that picture of them, the victory in that area in their minds. And so they would be able to filter out the things that would speak against that. I thank you that you have called us each, that you've made a place for each of us, that all things are possible there, that you're just telling us to come on. You're inviting us to come. Come and step into our promised land. And we choose today to step into our promised land to take possession of it. And we thank you that little by little we know that you will be driving out our enemies, that you will be going before us, going with us and surrounding us. Just pray for each person here this week as they go into the world, their jobs, their home, wherever they may be, that you will remind them at each juncture this is part of their promised land they can take, and that we would grow to become you to the world, that when people see us, they see you. When they step into our homes, in our offices, in our buildings, in our vehicles, they know they're with Jesus, and they know that they're in a piece of heaven. That we would, and I thank you for calling us to that, for partnering with us in that. And I just pray that we would continue to be faithful. In your precious name we pray, amen.